Hi, I'm Rudyard Griffiths, the Executive Director of The Hub. Welcome to In Conversation with David Frum. On this program, you'll hear big thinker and writer David Frum's exclusive analysis of contemporary events, issues, and ideas for The Hub. In Conversation with David Frum is hosted by The Hub's Editor-at-Large, Sean Spear. If you're enjoying this program, please visit our website at www.thehub.ca for more great insights into the big issues and ideas driving the public conversation.
Welcome to Hub Dialogues. I'm your host, Sean Spear, Editor-at-Large at The Hub. I'm honored to be back in conversation with David Frum for another installment of our bi-weekly video and podcast series on the key issues concerning Canadian policy and politics. In today's conversation, we'll discuss the latest developments in the Middle East in the aftermath of Iran's air attacks on Israel, including the possibility of a military response, the role of Israel's allies, including new and old ones, and what the whole episode tells us about the Biden administration's foreign policy. David, thanks as always for joining us.
Glad to be here.
A key subject of debate seems to be Iran's underlying motivations behind its attacks. Were they designed to do damage, or were they a symbolic response to Israel's bombing of an embassy in Syria? How have you come to think about this question, and to what extent does it matter in your mind?
The second point is really important. I'm not sure how much it does matter, but just for the record, these attacks were obviously meant to do enormous harm. That the amount of ordnance in the air, the number of pieces, the Iranians did not know that their attack would be as ineffective as it was. They did not know that the Israeli and coalition response would be as effective as it was. They had every reason to think that they would have not only done a lot of damage, but for the first time had affected a direct strike on Israeli territory from Iranian territory. It could have been really a bad thing, and it could have forced an immediate and devastating Israeli response had they hurt people, which would now plunge the region into a wider war. Thanks to the success of the defensive measures that the Israelis now have some time to think judiciously. Here, to my mind, though, is the most important thing that I take from this, because there has been some split within the pro-Israel community about how to react to the Americans' restraint on Israel. The United States has not said don't respond, but they have said respond in due time, deliberately, and please do not accelerate the spiral into a regional war. And what that translated to plainer English seems to mean is you want to hit Iran in Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, be our guest. Do not hit the Iranian mainland, or at any rate, do not hit the Iranian mainland with direct weapons. If you want to play cyber with the Iranian mainland, be our guest. But no direct from Israel rocket into Iran, and please don't do that. And there are many people who chafe and say, well, why should the United States tell Israel how to defend itself? So I just want to, here's the context. The last time anything like this happened to Israel was in 1990, when getting ready for the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein fired Scud missiles directly into Israeli territory. When that happened, the United States did offer Israel some assistance. They hastened a Patriot battery to Israel to help defend. The Patriot battery was not very effective. About a dozen people were killed and many more wounded. I think 13 were killed and a number wounded. I forget the number. And the United States said, and after that, but beyond that, no retaliation from you, absolutely forbidden. And not only that, we do not want or need your help. We do not need or want your help in the larger coalition against Saddam Hussein. You sit on the sidelines, take the punch, and leave the rest to us. The degree of cooperation 30 years later is so much vastly greater that this has been Israel, I think maybe for the first time in its history, the first time since the 1956 war, fought as part of a coalition alongside the U.S. Navy, alongside the Royal Air Force. Apparently French air detachments were there. The Jordanians played a role. The Saudis seem to have played a role. When you do coalition warfare, you gain the benefit of having many powerful friends. You pay the price of having to take into account the views of your coalition partners. I think that's a really good trade. If I were an Israeli, I would say I am willing to exchange some limit on what we do in exchange for the security that comes from being part of a greater alliance. Israel has never had this before. One more thing. I know I've given a long answer, but I think a lot of people in the pro-Israel community have this vision of this lost golden land of cooperation between the United States and Israel, when the United States at some unspecified point in the past had Israel's back more than it does today. And that's really untrue. It's really unhistorical. The United States did not even sell Israel weapons for cash until the middle 1960s. There's no U.S. aid to Israel until the middle 1970s. No American president visits Israel until Richard Nixon in 1974. And Ronald Reagan, who's a friend of Israel in so many ways, didn't visit at all for 8 years. It is only in very recent years that Israel gets the highest level of defense cooperation with the United States, that the relationship is becoming thicker and thicker and thicker. And the relationship in the past was much less protective. It is unsurprising that as the relationship gets thicker, the obligations begin to multiply on both sides of the table. And that, yes, Israel gets a lot of benefits from the United States. As it gets more, it also gets more obligations to the United States. And that is a sign of the success and strength of the relationship, not of somebody vetoing a country from doing what it needs to do.
A ton of insight there that listeners and readers can also find in a recent essay you penned for The Atlantic and your X account or your Twitter account, where you detailed the historical relationship between Israel and the United States. David, we'll come back to some of those points, particularly as it relates to the Biden administration's foreign policy. But I want to come back in the meantime to the extraordinary defense of the attacks that you talked about in your first answer. And in particular, what in your mind is the significance of the Arab states that came to Israel's defense in the face of this threat, and what it tells us about Israel's relationships within its own region?
Well, I think what it tells us a lot about Iran, that there's been a lot of diplomacy between Israel and the Arab states, but the thing that has been driving it is not because people have changed their minds or lost their particular histories or agendas or ideologies or systems of belief, but a lot of old enmities can seem less important in the face of a new threat. And as the Iranians have, over the past decade, become more and more reckless and aggressive, backing this horrific, truly genocidal war in Syria, if we're going to use that term properly, that drove a third of the population of Syria into exile, killed I don't know how many hundreds of thousands, used poison gas, as they have embarked on this campaign in Yemen, where they are trying to disrupt the shipping into the Red Sea. No country suffers more from that than Egypt, with the loss of Suez Canal revenues, that they have conjured into being a balancing coalition of Arab states against them. And because the Arab states, all of them even put together, are not as strong as Iran, they need to look for powerful friends. The United States, of course, but also Israel. With the Jordanians were defending their own airspace. The Iranians were aggressively flying weapons across Jordanian airspace. So, of course, Jordan had to do its best to intercept it. But the Jordanians on their own didn't have the capacity. They had to work with the British, with the French, and with the Americans, and probably with the Israelis and Saudis too, in order to do it. So that was a tremendous thing. Last thing about the success of the anti-missile campaign, Iron Dome. One of the reasons I've been hopping up and down so much about the long, long delay in voting the aid package that President Biden, he's been requesting this aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and so on from the beginning of 2023, but it became urgent after the October 7th attacks. And in October 20th, he sent a big package again. The package that Biden asked for on October 20th of 2023 included funding to triple the capacity of the Iron Dome defense. Israel has something like 25 Iron Dome interceptors, 25 Iron Dome launchers. This would have bought 100 new ones, which would have allowed some of the older ones to come out of service. But the effect, triple the number of launchers, more than triple the number of interceptor missiles that the Israelis could afford to stock. Those missiles are expensive. So if that money had been forthcoming in October, Israel could have been even more ready. As it was ready enough. But who knows when the next strike comes? This Iron Dome is a tremendously necessary system. It is very expensive to operate. And just as Israel is showing respect for American equities by not hitting back hard, so the United States should show respect for Israeli equities by making sure that Israeli citizens feel safe as they go about their lives.
You've generally lauded the Biden administration's support for Israel and Ukraine. Yet, of course, as you know, it's had its critics. What would you say to the argument that the administration said don't to the Iranians and they still went ahead with the attacks, just as Putin's Russia did in Ukraine, and that this in some way signals a perceived weakness on the part of the Biden administration by America's enemies?
When an American president says don't to someone like Iran, it doesn't mean that his wish is magically executed. It means that the person who violates the don't faces consequences. So what did Iran face? So Iran has just created a situation where the U.S. Navy fought alongside Israel. That has Nothing like that not only has never happened before, it's not even conceivable before. Biden originally did send some units into Israel after October 7th to be of standby assistance, but you had American ships directly fighting to protect Israel. That's never happened before. So part of the consequence of Iran's violation of the don't is a much more intense U.S.-Israel alliance, much more intense alliance between Israel and Britain and France. They brought into being at least a one-time partnership with Jordan. So that's part of the don't. And there will be a price. The price may be less visible than the thing they just inflicted. The price may take the form of, again, attacks on their equities in other places. It may take the form of another round of interference with their would-be nuclear program. But they have surely drawn the United States and Israel much closer together, and that has to be painful, as in Ukraine, when Russians went ahead anyway. They disregarded warnings from the United States. The price they paid, at least until recently, was the destruction of the better part of their army. All the best parts of the Russian army are destroyed, and were destroyed by Ukrainian troops using weapons provided by the United States and European allies.
Hi, Hub Podcast listeners. Maybe you've seen in this very same podcast feed a new program called Hub Headlines. It features the best analysis and thinking of our writers each and every morning. It's delivered to you in a convenient audio format in this podcast feed. All you have to do is click and download. And instead of reading Sean Spear, Howard Englund, Ginny Roth, any one of the terrific writers contributing to the Hub each daily, you can listen to them on the go. It's convenient. It's built for people like you with busy lives. If you're multitasking, if you enjoy the Hub but can't get on a screen, check out Hub Headlines. We've got you covered with the audio version of the Hub's best commentary and analysis each day. Again, you can grab this all on the same podcast feed that you are listening to this program now. Simply download each morning Hub Headlines and enjoy our best analysis and insights.
I want to check in on the state of Washington's support for Israel more generally. We previously discussed how there's much stronger bipartisan support for Israel than there is for Ukraine in Congress. Is that still the case in your mind? And how will the Iranian attack affect Washington's resolve?
It may be that we'll have a very concrete answer to that in the coming week, because as you and I speak, it is being much discussed. There'll be a series of separate votes on aid for Israel, aid for Ukraine. The Democrats have historically opposed, or until recently opposed, separate votes because they didn't trust the Republicans to honor. What they were afraid was the Republicans would send up an Israel vote and then get the Democratic votes for that and then say, that's it, we're done. So they wanted to make sure that there was a Ukraine vote scheduled too. So we'll be able to tally noses and see who supports how much. The coalitions, in both cases, there was majority support for both. The majorities look slightly different. With Israel, there is more support on the Republican right, less on the Democratic left. With Ukraine, there is support almost all the way to the very farthest fringe of the Democratic Party, but much less support among Republicans. But in both cases, we are dealing with majorities of the House of Representatives and very large majorities of the U.S. Senate. And both deserve it. And I hope that all people who value democracy and the Western security systems and the credit of America's world will say, these causes should not be separated from one another. It's the same drones that are attacking both Israel and Ukraine. Israel's drones are an Iranian design manufactured in Iran. The drones attacking Ukraine are now an Iranian design now manufactured in Russia, but with assistance from Iran. It's not exactly a single quarrel, but these are very interlocked quarrels. And you can't separate the Chinese component out of it. The Prime Minister of Japan came to Washington to say, the defense of East Asia begins in Ukraine. So don't think that you can say, I keep saying there are people who say, I want to default on Ukraine to be credible in Asia. I said, that's like trying to impress the mortgage company by defaulting on the utility bill. Your creditors want to see that you are paying all your bills, not some of the bills.
How will all of this affect the Israeli government's own thinking? Will it still go ahead and respond to the Iranian attacks? Or does it see this as an opportunity to strengthen the White House support for the Gaza campaign? Or is that even the right way to think about these questions, David?
The way I personally think about them is, in the book of Judges, there's an episode where Israel is attacked by the Midianites. And a prophet named Gideon is tasked by God to assemble an army to defeat the Midianites. And Gideon assembles, I believe, 10,000 men. And God says, that's too many. Send them away. I want only 300. Because if you defeat the Midianites with 10,000 people, you will think you deserve the credit. Whereas if you defeat them with 300, you'll know it's a miracle and I will get the credit and you will worship me. So when I look at Israeli governments, I think of the story of Gideon. If they were making good decisions in responsible ways, Israelis might think they did it. Whereas as is, only divine protection explains how it happened, because the Israeli government is making one crazy decision after another. It's got all kinds of people in it who shouldn't be in any government anywhere, who shouldn't even be in the press room outside the government. And I hope that they will make responsible choices. I hope they will understand the value of what Iran just created for them. Israel is now a coalition partner with all the restraints and difficulties that come with that, but with all of the extraordinary benefits that come from being a coalition partner. If you're a moderate-sized state, you want to be in a coalition backed by the United States if you possibly can.
One prospective coalition partner who seems to be on the outside looking in is Canada. Talk a bit, David, about Canadian government policy vis-a-vis Israel in the aftermath of a parliamentary motion that, amongst other things, ceased the Canadian government's supply of arms and other military equipment to Israel. What's your response to what you've seen out of Canada over the better part of the past month and of course, in recent days?
Well, Canada's a land of contrasts. On the one hand, magnificent abundance of opinions. On the other hand, desperate shortage of reasons for anyone to listen to Canadian opinions. Look, I don't expect that there would be Canadian Air Force units in the Middle East. Canada is going to be a hemispheric power, and its future is more and more as a Pacific power. So to the extent that there are Canadian resources, Canadian defense planning should be thinking about Taiwan first, as not because Taiwan is more important, but just it's a more natural place for Canada to make itself felt. But the fact is, Canada has made itself heard in a noisy way, but not made itself felt. And this is wrong. The lesson that the Israelis are getting on the positive side, Canadians are getting on the negative side. Canada is a coalition partner. It wants to be a coalition partner, but it doesn't want to pay its share of the dinner tab. And we are reminded again and again, as we've been so often over the past years, Canada has important interests. Canada has opinions that Canadians deeply cherish. Canada needs to be heard. Canada needs to bring something to the table that commands respect. Because as is, Canada's had, and this government has had so many different opinions on the Middle East. I mean, you don't need any more opinions outside the government than the government contains within itself, where the Hamas attacks are utterly unacceptable and it's completely behind Israel. No, Israel is to be boycotted and condemned. It's ready to think that it's going to praise Israel. No, if some bunch of random strangers says Israel is committing a genocide, Canada will go along with that. Every opinion is there. But what is not there is anything that commands respect for the opinion. So maybe either do more or speak less.
That's a thoughtful way to wrap up our conversation, a conversation, David, that I value greatly. We've missed your voice here at Hub Dialogues. Of course, we've understood why you've not been with us. But I think I speak on behalf of our entire community when we say we're so glad to have you back. I look forward to catching up in a couple of weeks.
Thank you for listening to In Conversation with David Frum, brought to you by The Hub, Canada's leading source for analysis and insights on public policy. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode. Please share your favorite Hub podcast with friends and family and subscribe wherever you get your audio online. We also appreciate your ratings and reviews, so please leave us one. And a friendly reminder that you can access a video version of this recording anytime on YouTube. Simply search for The Hub or The Hub Canada, or go to our website, www.thehub.ca. I'm The Hub's Executive Director, Rudyard Griffiths. The host of today's program was Sean Speer, The Hub's Editor-at-Large. This episode was produced by Amal Atar-Guzman. The Hub's audio producers are Alex Glutch and David Matta.